This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and this is The Signal. Whether or not you know it, the developed world relies on cobalt.
Demand for cobalt has soared. Uh-huh. The price of cobalt has actually doubled in the last year.
And most of that cobalt comes from unregulated mines in the Democratic Republic of Congo that are staffed partly by kids.
Those that are 4 years, 5 years would be hand-picking. It has been called the worst form of child labour and it qualifies.
The world's only getting hungrier for cobalt, but is there a fair way to get it? And is there anything you can do? That's today's episode. Okay, so this is one of those grim things about the modern industrialised world, right? Generally, if it seems too good and cheap and useful to be true, someone's probably getting done over further down the production line.
Ugh, bleak but true. So in this case, it's smartphones and electric cars, or more specifically the cobalt that's used to stabilise their batteries. And people getting done over are adults and kids in the Democratic Republic of Congo who are working in these mines under insanely bad conditions for very little money.
Yeah, so we spoke to a reporter who's looked into exactly what these mines are like.
Alrighty. Do you just want to say your full name on tape, Lynn, so that we've got it?
Yep, sure. So my full name is Lynn Evelyn.
Great. And you've been looking into the cobalt trade. Firstly, I mean, I remember cobalt as an element on the periodic table from high school, but that's about it. Where is cobalt used in the modern world?
We use cobalt to stabilize batteries and make them safer, among other things as well. So, so they're pretty much everywhere. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. So demand for cobalt has soared. Uh-huh. The price of cobalt has actually doubled in the last year.
So, in the last year?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Yes.
And we have cobalt here in Australia.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
But where's the big, like, which parts of the world where cobalt kind of comes from?
In Central Africa, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's where the majority of cobalt is. You know, so that's sort of the source of where this child labour situation is as well.
Yeah. So tell us about the mines in the DRC. So obviously it is, you know, the place, it's the place where the vast majority of all this cobalt is coming from. What are these mines like?
So these mines are artisanal mines, meaning that they're basically informal mines.
Artisanal mines.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Stephen's not laughing because he thinks that child slavery is funny. He's laughing because sounds a little bit like a hand cream
kind of mine industry. I mean, what's an artisanal mine?
It's basically an informal mine. It's a mine that's it's makeshift in nature. It could be in somebody's backyard, for example.
Okay.
And these artisanal mines are not, they don't have, you know, your full safety processes and machinery in place. They'll just be literally a hole dug in the ground by somebody using rudimentary equipment.
Okay, so you have these ad hoc mines with workers, including children, using pretty basic equipment to dig this stuff up. In some cases, they're just using their bare hands.
Yeah, and then there are these groups trying to monitor the problem. Lynn spoke to Sister Catherine Mutindi from the Good Shepherd International Foundation. So this is a group that tries to help workers at Kolwezi, where a lot of these mines have cropped up, and they're particularly trying to help kids.
Some will be going to the mines from 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. This is the latest that they can begin to get to the mines. Children are not strong enough, so they don't quite go into the digging, into the deep holes. They can dig on the surface. Those that are 4 years, 5 years would be hand-picking. They walk around and identify the stones of value. So the condition is that the whole day they are out there, there is no lunch, there is no meal, there is no water, there is no shade. It has been called the worst form of child labour and it qualifies.
Do we see fatalities in these mines?
Yes, and that's, again, confirmed to me through the people that I've spoken to. Yannick said that he's seen firsthand people die. So there would be extreme weather events and then there's landslides and people are literally stuck in these tunnels people don't have enough time to get out of these tunnels when generators fail, for example, because there's a lack of oxygen when you get deep into the earth. And so people lose limbs or are just stuck down there and never found.
And this account of conditions is backed up by Lynn's interview with a guy named Yannick. He started working in the mines when he was 7, and we had part of his story translated.
When I was going to the mines, it was to look after my family. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of suffering. My father was dead, so I decided to give up on school and go work in the mines. I gave up on studying to help my mother. She was sick, my father was dead, and his family did not look after us. When we were working there and someone hurt himself, we could not even look at him. The person had to go and get treated on his own. We were there to work, and we were working for not a lot of money. It is not good to let the children work at the mines. It's not even just the mines. There's also children that carry the gear, there's fights, and there's a lot of ambush. You need to come and help. A lot of children die. Their parents also die.
This phrase that Yannick uses, ambush in the mines, what is it that he's talking about there?
So, I wasn't sure. So I asked Sister Catherine. She said to me that in these mines there are these, sometimes there are organised child prostitution, and there's also a lot of corruption that's happening there as well. So she talks about how, women and young girls are getting sold off in these artisanal mines, and it's just, she says, a hell of a thing. That's how she described it.
So child exploitation and trafficking and these, just death traps of mines. Mm. And then the cobalt itself also comes with its own health risks. So Amnesty International is another group that keeps an eye on this industry. And one of their campaigners, Lauren Armstead, she has been to the DRC.
The cobalt is toxic. It's toxic in itself. In the short term, it causes kind of irritation and kind of respiratory problems. But long term, it can cause a fatal lung disease called hard metal lung disease. And that's just from handling it, so even those who aren't engaged at the stuff down in the pits, are they chipping it out, people who are just sorting it and washing it on the surface. A lot of the women are engaged in washing and transporting the cobalt. Although we did meet one woman who went down into the pits, generally they don't do that. So everyone that is engaged in handling the cobalt up and down that part of the supply chain is exposed to, really serious health risks.
So, Lynn, what do we actually know about, how many kids are working in these mines?
It's very, very difficult to say, and depending on who you speak to or what study you look at, you'll get different numbers. But a widely cited figure is from UNICEF in 2014, they said that there were roughly 40,000 children working in the south of the DRC in these cobalt mines.
40,000 kids.
Mm. And I'm guessing if cobalt's become that much more valuable in the last year or so, that number will only have gone up.
Yes, and that's actually exactly what Sister Catherine said to me. She said that numbers are actually going up. And part of the problem is that there's a lack of viable alternatives or sources of income or employment there.
So this is the other thing, right? People are paid these shockingly low wages, a dollar or two a day. But like Lynn was saying, there just aren't many other options for people in the DRC.
Which surely makes this an intractable problem in some ways, right?
Yeah, perhaps. But Amnesty and Lynn do have some advice for consumers.
The message really is call up the companies that you buy these household products from. Ask them, where are you getting your raw materials from? Ask them to get back to you with concrete answers in relation to their supply chains.
Knowing all this does kind of... expose us all to it as well. Does it, you know, knowing, having looked into this as extensively as you have, do you kind of think differently about your phone now? And is that a good thing?
What it's taught me is to be more aware of products and where they come from. And as I said to you, Stephen, I'm more sort of focused on, you know, if I'm going to buy something, checking, you know, what has the company done? Because there's so many public documents that companies are required to provide, annual reports, sustainability reports. So you can check, you know, what are they doing and what are they saying about this issue?
But
so
it, that's but it's kind of all the companies, right? So it's like if you want to have a phone,
you
might end up having a phone that has cobalt from the DRC.
Yeah, I mean, that's an unfortunate truth. But I mean, having said that, I know that Apple, for example, has done a lot in this space. Yeah.
Right.
So they've now been able to say that in the last 2 years, they have been able to 100% verify where their cobalt has come from.
Oh, interesting.
And do audits. So companies are doing more now, but there are still some that are lagging behind.
Okay, so some companies are doing something, but even then the supply chain that gets cobalt out of these tiny little independent mines all the way to the assembly line in electronics factories has got to be pretty impossible to map a lot of the time.
Well, totally, yeah, because these factories might be somewhere like China, but that excuse that it's too hard to map, that might be not good enough of an excuse for much longer, because right now the Australian Parliament is preparing to vote on a bill that would force thousands of companies, maybe 3,000, companies that are trading here to report on where their products come from. And if it gets through, it'll be called the Modern Slavery Act.
So slavery is quite a specific thing, right? Mm. Would the bill cover things like labour conditions in these Congolese cobalt mines?
Well, yeah. I mean, actually, it looks like it might. So to hear a bit more about that, we caught up with Jennifer Byrne. She's a professor at the UTS Law School in Sydney, and she works for an organisation called Anti-Slavery Australia too.
We know through globalisation that we see goods that are becoming cheaper and cheaper. And, you know, we wonder about the source of those goods. You know, it's extraordinary for any of us, really, to go into any of the major supermarkets or department-type stores and just see how cheap these goods are. We know that they're made overseas, imported into Australia, but, you know, it's unimaginable, really, that you can buy a toaster for around about $10. You know, you kind of wonder about that.
Yeah, you definitely do. So how would this law work?
Well, essentially, it would apply to all big companies that trade in Australia. And actually, it's not just companies. It would also apply to bodies like universities and public hospitals too.
What the Modern Slavery Bill does is that it requires entities in Australia with an annual consolidated revenue of over $100 million to submit a modern slavery statement each year.
Right, to Parliament.
They have to prepare it. They have to submit it to a government-controlled register, which is yet to be established, but it will be a publicly available statement.
Okay, and that will be, and what will they have to put into that statement?
Okay, so there are what are called the mandatory criteria, and this is all experimental because we don't have it yet. But, you know, there are mandatory criteria. So the company or the entity has to describe its structure, operations, and its supply chains. Mm-hmm. It has to identify any risks in the supply chains, say what it's doing to address those risks, and then consider the effectiveness of its actions in identifying and responding to the risk of modern slavery in the supply chain.
It'd be fair to say then, if you're David Jones or Kmart or Target or JB Hi-Fi, a store like that, you're going to have quite a lot of work after this.
You're going to have a whole lot of work.
If these companies lodge statements which are inadequate, is there some sort of mechanism to, you know, will the body that registers these statements be able to say, look, we're not really convinced about this part of your report? I mean, do we know how that's going to work?
Well, Stephen, that's a big issue. So that's what a lot of people are turning their minds to right now, is we're all racing to put in our submissions.
And it's not clear yet.
No, it's not clear.
Just a final thing on that bill. So it's been tabled in the lower house. And as Jennifer Byrne said, there's a committee holding hearings on it right now. But it's got cross-party support. So, you know, there's a good chance it could be law in Australia by Christmas.
That's the Signal for today. Thanks for listening. And a big thank you to Lynn Evelyn, who brought us that story. If you're liking the podcast, don't forget to subscribe and rate and review us in iTunes.
Yep. And if you want to get in touch with Ange or me, we're both on Twitter and we have an email address, which is thesignal@abc.net.au. We'll be back in your podcast feed tomorrow. Bye.
Bye.